If you've listened to any of the training days online, you will hear some things that you have heard there. But I'm also going to address some things and even show a couple of videos. One on the back end, the very last thing that I'm going to do is show a video kind of leading the night or ending the night, and then also one leading into the first break. The first video is like a 3-minute video, and then the last one is about a 6-minute video. So I'm going to share some things that way. And also I'm going to emphasize some things tonight that are questions that have come up a little more often, more frequently over the last number of years that I'll hit a little bit later on, but just know that I'm going to hit them. Questions like, what does it mean to be married in God's eyes? We hear that quite a bit. People say, I'm married in God's eyes. Doesn't matter about a piece of paper. Doesn't matter about a ceremony. So I want to address the question a little bit later. What does the Bible say about marriage? What, in fact, marries you? Why is a ceremony, if it is, important? Is it necessary? Those kinds of things. What, in fact, marries you? Is it the piece of paper? Or is it something else? And so we'll hit that question. We'll also talk about the whole topic of living together and things like that, things pertaining to that question. Very, very relevant. I've hit that question in the past. We'll address why statistics don't bear out that living together is a recipe for success. In fact, statistics, plain statistics, evidence something different. But we'll hit that, talk about that, because I know in this city, it's certainly a relevant topic for a number of reasons. The expense of this city, but also what's common in our culture, and so on. Before I get into the stuff tonight, I also think it's okay going over some things that we've done before, because if you've heard this particular training day or aspects of it before, you may be in a different place right now than you were the last time. You may be dating someone now, you may be married now where you weren't before, or vice versa. So if you came last time and you were in that infatuation period of a relationship, you were going to hear things at that time a lot different than maybe you do now if you're broken up and you're really angry at that person and you're ripped off and you wish you did some things different. You wish you maybe listened to some things or considered some things different. This is also new for me. I'm a lot farther along than I was even 5, 6, 7 years ago. I even have, I won't point where he is, but I have family here. I even have my son, one of my sons, sitting in this. So that's really curbing how I talk a little bit. I don't know if it'll curb too much, because we've been trying to be very frank and open with I have two boys, a 12-year-old and a 10-year-old. My 10-year-old isn't here tonight, but my 12-year-old is. But we've been trying to be very open with our kids in as much as they can handle, but we've used the word penis and vagina and those kinds of words early on. I remember having a talk with my younger son about 4 or so years ago, and I was trying to explain how babies were made, and I was talking about how daddy puts his penis in mommy's vagina and then sperm comes out, and one sperm is a great sperm and has a great relationship with an egg, and it's and I thought I was doing a really good job explaining to my maybe 6-year-old son. And then he asked me the question, Daddy, what makes the sperm come out? It's like, man, like the grace of God, the grace of God. It's glorious grace of God. That's what it is. Ask me when you're 16. So I'm still learning this kind of stuff and explaining it. So it's new for me in some ways as I kind of filter it through kind of new places where I'm at and so on. So with that in mind, let me kind of give you some intro comments, set the stage. I'll pray. The front half, I'm going to give you maybe some statistics that you've heard before. I don't want to overwhelm you with some statistics, but I also want you to appreciate that maybe if you're living in a bit of a secluded space, a huddled space, a quartered off space, I want you to have a sense of what's going on in the culture. And for those of you who are very understanding of what's going on in our culture around us, this will only affirm some things. But let me just set the stage by reading a couple of things. The first is a quote by L. Mohler, who is a theologian. He's the president of the Southern Baptist Convention, but a good man. He writes this, Christians have no right, you can read this on the screen, that's right, have no right to be embarrassed when it comes to talking about sex and sexuality. An unhealthy reticence or embarrassment in dealing with these issues is a form of disrespect to God's creation. Whatever God made is good, and every good thing God made has an intended purpose that ultimately reveals his own glory. When conservative Christians respond to sex with ambivalence or embarrassment, we slander the goodness of God and hide God's glory, which is intended to be revealed in the right use of creation's gifts. As you know, if you're a part of this ministry, we talk about it all the time, and that is we exist to make Jesus known. That's our mission statement. So I want us to understand as we tackle this particular subject tonight that the discussion about sex and all that's connected to it is ultimately about Jesus, whether you believe that, agree with that or not. But the reason why I say that is because of things said in places like Colossians 1, a text that I've referred to many times over the years, where Paul writes, by Jesus all things were created, and in Jesus all things hold together, and that for him all things exist. All things exist. Everything exists for Jesus. I like what John Piper, another favorite of mine, I haven't quoted from Johnny P for a long time, but John Piper writes in his book, Sex and the Supremacy of Christ. By the way, if you're looking at picking up certain books, it is a fantastic one. It comes out of a conference that he did with a number of other people. But he writes, sexuality is designed by God as a way to know God in Christ more fully. And knowing God in Christ more fully is designed as a way of guarding and guiding our sexuality. Therefore, all misuses of our sexuality distort the true knowledge of Christ, and all misuses of our sexuality derive from not having a true knowledge of Christ. To put it another way, all sexual corruption serves to conceal the true knowledge of Christ, but the true knowledge of Christ serves to prevent sexual corruption. So with all that in mind, the two questions that we, if you're a follower of Jesus and coming here tonight, should be asking coming into tonight is one, how can I know Jesus more through my sexual life? And number two, how can I make Jesus known more through my sexual life? We'll talk about that on the back end. On the back end, I'll talk about the two ways in this city that you can make Jesus known and just give you a taste. One is through how we do our sexuality, how we live that out. You will make Jesus known. You will stand out if you seek to make Jesus known by how you do your sexuality, how that gets lived out, personified in your life. The other, how you do your money. Those two things, you do those two things seeking to make Jesus known and glorify him, you will stand out in this city. You will have people write blogs about you in this city. They will get angry with you in this city, but you will also evidence very much and very clearly that you are a follower of Jesus. A couple other quotes, and I'll pray. Another individual, Bruce Marshall, he writes this in terms of this aspect of making Jesus known through our sexuality. And what I want to try to convince you of tonight, at least help you consider, at least in part, is that your pursuit of sexual intimacy, I would argue, is a demonstration of a greater pursuit of wanting to know God more intimately. Bruce Marshall, that individual that I referenced a second ago, he writes, the young man who rings the bell at the brothel is unconsciously looking for God. What Marshall saw, but too few people are seeing today, is that there is a deep connection between God and sex. There just is. Peter Kreeft, he's a Catholic theologian, he writes that sex is the effective religion of our culture. See, here's what I don't think I need to argue for tonight, or at least very much, and that is sex is good. I don't think I have to argue for that. Sex is good because the God who created sex is good. What will be harder for some of you to agree with is that God is glorified greatly when we receive his gift with thanksgiving and enjoy it the way that he has created it to be enjoyed. So my goal tonight is not to make you have less sex. That's not my goal. My goal is to help you enjoy sex in great measure as God has designed it to be enjoyed. So if you come in here and you're a little skeptical because this is a church, I'm a pastor, I'm an old man, and you think that's the motivation, that's not my motivation. I want you to have a great sex life. I want you to enjoy it in as much as God wants it to be enjoyed, and that is in great measure. What I want us to see tonight in this topic is that sexuality points to something bigger, something greater. It's what Philip Yancey refers to as a rumor of something to come. It's a foretaste. It's what N.T. Wright speaks of as an echo. It's an echo of something else, something greater. Again, it's a foreshadowing of something grander, grander to come. I think that's enough preface statement stuff. Let me pray, then we'll start going through some stuff together. Father, I thank you for the allowance of this time. And Father, I pray that you would guide me and guide all of us to consider this topic in ways that maybe we haven't considered it before. I pray that through this discussion and just the chewing of this on this topic and hearing some things in light of our own life and practices, that we would seek through this, through our sexuality, to glorify you in grand ways and also enjoy it in the way that you have for us to enjoy. That's my desire. I also pray that much grace would rest on this time, because anytime you talk about this topic, there's a lot of hurt and woundedness. When we talk about dating and relationships, there's a lot of people that have been stung, been put off. Some people that are here maybe lonely. And wondering what's next, if any, and where you are in that. So I pray that this would be a time of great grace as well. I pray it would be a helpful time too, maybe to help us see things, consider things that we haven't seen and considered before that will serve us well, so that we wouldn't have to look back with regret or pain and so forth. So guide us tonight, I pray. Help me as I teach. Help all of us as we listen, and may you be glorified in the midst of it. In Jesus' name, amen. Let me give you, I've done this before, but I think it may be good for some of us. Let me give you a little brief history of dating. Don't know how many of you know. I think this is really important just to help you understand that the whole practice of dating is a fairly new practice. The word date or dating was introduced actually back in the late 1800s. The word date was actually a slang term. It was a slang term used for booking an appointment with a prostitute. Nice to think of it that way. In the early 1900s, women's magazines began taking a more proactive role in telling women how to be, dress like this, dress like that, act like that, buy this. By the 1920s came with the birth and popularity of the movie theater. Dance halls, restaurants, resulting in more and more people congregating outside of the home. So there would be relationships fostered, people meet more so outside of the home. In the 1930s, the automobile became more prevalent, making it easier to pick someone up, take them out, and again, no longer meeting in the home even more so. In the 1940s, men started figuring out that dating took a lot of money. And in that realization, there came an expectation of receiving favors for the money spent to be seen as, became to be seen as more and more acceptable, which, if you really think about it, is the definition of prostitution, but became more prevalent in the 1940s. According to Beth Bailey, in the mid-1950s, Beth Bailey, she wrote a book called From the Front Porch to the Back Seat, Courtship in the 20th Century, if you want to read on the history of dating. But coming out of the 1950s, the youth dating culture spoke of going steady. Going steady or going out in modern language was not a new custom, but an old custom with a new meaning. Let me just quote something from her. She writes that in earlier days, going steady had been more like the old-fashioned keeping steady company. It was a step along the path to marriage. Even if many steady couples parted company before they reached the altar, by the early 1950s, going steady had acquired a totally different meaning. It was no longer the way a marriageable couple signaled their deepening intentions. Instead, going steady was something 12-year-olds could do and something most 15-year-olds did do. Few steady couples expected to marry each other, but for the duration of the relationship, acted as if they were married, going steady to become a sort of play marriage, a mini cry of actual marriage. And then we get to the 1960s. And with the 1960s comes hyperfeminism, and the sexual revolution takes place, and the introduction of the pill, making casual sex a much more common practice. Also, pornography is introduced to the culture. You can go to the store and you could buy pornography for the first time, totally reshaping mainly men's, but not only men's, mindset regarding women and sex and practices. I won't give you statistics on pornography, but I've done a lot of study on this over the years and actually had people research the topic for me. But as recently as just the last number of years, according to one survey, 50% of all men state that they have an addiction to pornography. They view it on a regular basis. Upwards of some studies suggest that women, 20% of women do as well. Promise Keepers, big men's movement. I was actually very surprised at that women's stat, by the way. I don't know why, but I just was. I don't know if that says something about me or I'm just a little ignorant on certain things. But Promise Keeper, big event, ministry thing, filling stadiums. They did a survey at a Promise Keepers event, and 50% of the men that attended this event that took place in a very large venue stated that over 50% stated that they looked at and viewed pornography in the last week. So it's prevalent. I know it is. Most of the discussions I have with guys hit that topic very much. I could give you a lot of stats if you want a lot of stats. I can give them to you. In the 1970s, legalized abortion, no-fault divorce are introduced, making the killing of babies allowable, walking away without the hassle of marriage easier to do. So here we've gone about 75, 80 years. We've progressed, and all of this has reshaped our culture of dating and marriage and sexuality. We think the way things are today have been this way forever, when really it's a fairly recent phenomena. It's a brief history of dating, the way things are, and how we really have conformed to the patterns of this world in regards to this, at least our mindsets, at least chewing on it. How do we live this out? How do we live Christianly when it comes to dating and our sexuality and so forth, and we'll hit that a little bit later, but it's a really fairly recent phenomena. Let me give you some dating and sex stats, all right, just again to lay the stage. Some of you have heard some of these before, but some of them may resonate more so with you tonight for whatever reason. The numbers of individuals engaging in premarital sex in the past 20 years has increased 63%. The two most common dating and sexual practices on campus today, really two extremes. Two most common dating practices. One is casual sex, and then the other is the total opposite in terms of Klingons. Those dating couples that just can't not be without one another. Most common dating practice is constant togetherness. 45% of girls, 48% of guys have had intercourse by the time they graduate high school. 6 in 10, 15 to 25-year-olds report having intercourse at least once in their lives during that period of time, most remaining active after their first experience. Today, it's less common to be a virgin on your wedding day than not. The number one reason why teens have sex is the belief that having sex will lead to greater peer support and a gain in social status. 61% of women and 36% of men view virginity as a gift, but 57% of men and 21% of women view it as a stigma. It's mocked today. We have movies like The 40-Year-Old Virgin. It's mocked. 34% of men, 10% of women confess to having told a lie to have a sexual encounter. And although teen pregnancy rates are dropping, and this is a U.S. stat, still today 900,000 U.S. teens get pregnant every year. How long do people wait before they have sex? There's a survey done where they surveyed 3,423 people. And this is what they said. How long do we wait? Less than a week, 10%. 2 to 3 weeks, 37%. Over a month, 50%. And after a first date, 3%. How do people define sex? So if this is a history of dating and this is some stats on dating, sexual practice, and so forth. How do people define sex? Now, this is a really important question because I've butted up against this in discussions in my office a number of times over the years. How do we define it? Big important question. We're going to talk about that a little bit later in greater detail, but let me give you some stats on how people define it and see how they measure up to how you define it. So do you define sex, in other words, as just intercourse, or as oral sex, sex, anal sex, sex, mutual masturbation, sex? What is sex to you? If you pull out, is that not sex? If you don't have an orgasm, is that not sex? And so forth. So what is sex? Let me give you some stats. Well, you obviously get that labeling what sex is depends on the type of behavior, anal sex, oral sex, vaginal sex, and whether participants reach orgasm is how people define it. About 60% of people believe that oral sex is not sex, and 20% feel that anal sex is not sex. But interestingly, at least to me, males were more likely to consider certain behaviors sex than women. Participants applied a different standard to themselves when labeling a behavior sex than they applied to their significant other for 9 out of 11 sexual behaviors. Participants were more likely to identify their other, the other in the relationship who engaged in behavior outside of their relationships, as having sex than they were to consider their own same behavior outside of the relationship. In other words, somewhat hypocritical. Participants were more likely to consider an activity sex if an orgasm occurred, and the one who achieved the orgasm was more likely to consider the encounter sex than their partner was. Adolescents believe that oral sex is more acceptable for their age group than vaginal sex. In fact, they believe that vaginal sex was much more against their moral, ethical, or religious beliefs. Being in love or not really didn't change the outcome of the data. The danger in this, and I've shared this before, but helps us understand, when asked if she was having sex, a 21-year-old undergrad said no, for she did not consider her experience with oral genital contact of penile anal intercourse sex, leading her physician and partners to presume that she and they were not at risk for STDs. In other words, are you having sex? Uh-uh. But fully involved and certainly prone to incurring STDs. Those who were religiously involved at 11 and 21, so from they were religiously involved at 11 and then later at 21, so they stayed the course, in other words, they were 4 times more likely to be sexually abstinent than those with no involvement at their age. One study followed 2,122 freshman college students who came into college with conventional religious values and showed a much lower rate of premarital intercourse by the end of their senior year of college. A couple more really quick stats, or a few more. STDs, condom use, those kinds of things. The rates of chlamydia have increased by 86% since 1997. Gonorrhea has gone up 132%. Syphilis, 900%. The most notable increase in HIV diagnoses have been among young women. In 1996, 14% of HIV diagnoses in the age group of 15 to 29 were women. Today is over 35%, so it's gone up from 14 to 35% with HIV diagnoses. 4 in 10 sexually active 15 to 24-year-olds who had been with multiple partners stated that they had not used a condom the last time they had intercourse. What about this and the effects on relationships going forward? Are there anything that show what our practices are as high school students, college students, young adults? Does this play a part in terms of our relationships as we go forward? And also, how does a relationship, marriage that does not last, ends in divorce, what effect does that have on relationships as well? So let's go from just the act, physical act of sex, and let's start broadening, start talking about relationships a little bit more. Women who were sexually active prior to marriage faced a considerably higher risk of marital disruptions than women who were virgins when they married. 37% of college women whose parents divorced reporting hooking up more than 6 times, compared to 13% of women from intact families. If you want to know where these stats come from, just email me and I can send you where you can find them. Children are 50% more likely to develop health problems following divorce. 3 times more likely to have a child out of wedlock, 75% more likely to divorce themselves. In 1969, 14% of all marriages ended in divorce, with a high of 50.6% in 1987. That was a high water mark. The average age of those divorcing for the first time, 43 years old for men, 40 and a half for women. The chances of divorce for those already divorced and remarried is 65%. So it goes up to that number. I'll talk about what the actual number for divorce is in just a second. 60% of all divorces are by couples married less than 15 years. The highest rate of divorce occurs between years 4 and 5. We were talking about this with the staff this week, talking about it's why marriage prep is so important. Marriage prep, but also coming back to that marriage in year 3, 4, 5, where the honeymoon is literally and figuratively over. And I was really surprised by that number, year 4 and 5. The chance that a divorced person will remarry is 75% for men, 65% for women. Today, it's often stated that half of all marriages end in divorce. Not exactly true. The best numbers that we have is that of those marriages that last 30 years, about 40% of them will end in divorce. But I said that the high water mark for marriages ending in divorce was 1987, 50.6%. But what must be also kept in mind, because some people can read that and go, that's fantastic, man. Divorce is going down 50% to 40%. What must be kept in mind in this discussion is the number of those living together has increased dramatically over the last 20 years. Since 1990, the rate of those choosing to live together has increased 46%. In 1970, 11% of couples lived together. Today, it's over 50%. Today, for the first time in our history, more kids are born out of wedlock. Today, very first time, 25% of those claiming to be born again live together. 25%, 37% who claim to be Christian live together. Now, again, some of you hear those stats and may go, that's fantastic, it's great, and conclude, well, that also shows that, or it shows at the very least, that living together is a better deal. A good deal, because if living together has increased and divorce is going down, then at least people living together are coming together and realizing, well, this isn't a good thing, and perhaps we shouldn't get married. I'll talk about that more. You're not alone in your thoughts, by the way, in that. In one study, 60%, as high as another study I saw, 74% of graduating high schoolers believed that living together before marriage is a good idea to see if you get along. So all 6 out of 10, perhaps even more than that, who are graduating high schoolers. The irony, and I'm going to come back to this, and this is the last stat that I'll give you as we move on. The irony being that those who choose to live together have a 46% greater chance of divorcing if they eventually do get married. And I'm going low water on that one. I've seen some stats are even more so. But 46% greater chance. In another comparison study, cohabitators were less likely to say they enjoyed sex. So we're going to talk on the back end why choosing to live together before marriage is more a recipe for divorce than anything else. I'm going to talk about why that is. I've talked about it before. Some of you have heard it before, but I think it'll be a good reminder to you. It's very current today. And we'll hit it. But let's stop at this point, and let me change the course a little bit, and let me ask this question. What does the Bible say about sex? What does it talk about? I didn't give you any handouts, so if you want to take notes, you can. Some verses will come across the screen, not all of them, but I'll reference all of them. But here's the first thing. What does the Bible say about sex? God gave it to us, and it's good. God gave us sex, and it is good. Genesis 2, 22 and 24. This isn't on the screen. You can take that off, and I'll help you out, VJ. I know I'm going to go through these quick. But Genesis 2, 24 and 22 and 24, and the rib that the Lord God had taken from the man, he made into a woman and brought her to the man. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. It's God's idea, God's gift. And it's very good. Now, what did God give us sex for? Well, one of the things that God gave us sex for was procreation. In fact, I would say that that is God's greatest gift to us in allowance to participate in the creation of that which is very good. I think it's the greatest of all gifts that he's given to us. He allows us to participate in that act. So one is procreation. Genesis 1:28 on the screen. God blessed them. God said to them, be fruitful and multiply. I mean, have sex, man. Have sex, have kids, have sex, have kids. First instructions, fantastic. Eat a pomegranate, have sex. Fill the earth, subdue it, have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth. So procreation, have kids. He gave it to us, allowing to participate in creation. He also gave it to us for pleasure. Proverbs 5, 18 and 19, I'll go through these one after the other. We read there, may your fountain be blessed, and may you rejoice in the wife of your youth, a loving doe, a graceful deer. May her breasts satisfy you always. May you ever be captivated by her love. Song of Songs, the Song of Solomon, every 17-year-old's favorite book of the Bible. Song of Songs, chapter 1, verse 2. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is more delightful than wine. Song of Songs, chapter 2, verse 3. Like an apple tree among the trees of the forest is my lover among the young men. I delight to sit in his shade, and his fruit is sweet to my taste. And I don't think she's talking about, again, pomegranates there, unless pomegranates is a euphemism for pomegranates, if you know what I mean. So we just see this pleasure. Pleasure, pleasure, enjoy. It's not only for procreation, enjoy. Here's the problem, and there have been several books that have been written for Christian women, especially, is that you grow up, and it's not only to you, but oftentimes it is, and this is an issue, and we've got resources if you want to look at them, but most of us, we grow up in families where they don't talk about it. Don't talk. If you grow up in a Christian family, pastors are scared to talk about it. You don't talk about it. Don't talk about it. Don't do it. Don't do it. That's the only thing. That's the only thing. All of a sudden, boom, one day, supposed to flick a switch, and all of a sudden, that which has been talked about negatively, don't do it. Nobody really speaks anything into your life. And there is a tough process, a transition that many fail to make. In going from that place to a place of pleasure and enjoyment and books and conferences specifically geared toward Christian women who have grown up in that atmosphere have been produced and are out there. But that's an issue. We don't talk about it because parents are nervous to talk about it. Pastors are nervous to talk about it. And it creates a culture that brings with it a lot of problems. But God is not down on pleasure. He's given us sex for pleasure. God is down on us settling. That's what God is down on. What else? Why else have we been given sex, which is good? Well, glorification reasons. 1 Corinthians 10:3, not on the screen. But whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. 1 Corinthians 19 and 20, which is on the screen. Paul writes, you are not your own, for you were bought with a price. So glorify God in your body. If you're a follower of Jesus, your body's not yours. It's not. You have been bought with a price, and so we are to glorify God in our bodies. But could it possibly be that lovemaking is not just for procreation and not just for pleasure, but for sanctification and glorification and exaltation for worship? Could it be that we have to think of ourselves more than just animals with urges or simply pleasure givers and receivers, but glory givers? Couldn't there be that possibility? But if that's the case, then how should we do sex as followers of Jesus? Could it be that we are never more like Jesus than when we give ourselves away in a union with our spouse, that it is more blessed to give than receive, even in our sexual relationships with our spouses? So that's why it's a good gift. It's a good gift, a gift to give pleasure, but it's also a gift to be done in such a way that we glorify God even in that. Even in that. What else does the Bible say about our sexuality? Well, any positive, from beginning to end, any positive instruction for sex in the Bible is given to those in marriage. Any positive instruction. There are instructions, obviously, and there's much written in terms of negatives, but any positive instruction is given to a husband and wife. Genesis 2:24, therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Jesus affirming this and pointing to this as something that's crossing cultures and time says in Matthew 19:5, which is on the screen, Jesus said, therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and then the two shall become one flesh. So the positive aspects of our sexuality given to husbands and wives in marriage. 1 Corinthians 7:3-4. The husband shall fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but yields it to her husband. In the same way, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but yields it to his wife. If I were you, especially men, memorize that verse before you get married. Your body ain't yours. It's mine. My body. Have at it, right? I definitely got the better of that deal in my relationship. But man, we're one. Your body's not your own. Fulfill your duty. I'll fulfill my duty. Let's come together. Whole aspect of this, when we do marriage prep, and we cover the whole topic of sex in marriage, is that sex in marriage should never be held out as some sort of punishment or even reward. Do this, and then maybe I'll do this for you, or I'm angry at you, I'm holding back this. You are not your own. Glorify God in your body, but your body is no longer yours. It's your husband's, and your husband's body is no longer yours. It's his wife's. Hebrews 13:4, not on the screen. Let marriage be held in honor among all. Let the marriage bed, be held in honor among all. So it's honorable. The instruction is positive to husbands and wives and speaks that way. Couple other things before leading into the video that I want to show you in a bit. Actually, no, that's going to take a little bit. How does the Bible speak of sexual sin? So if these are the positives, so the positive instructions go to husbands and wives to be enjoyed, pleasure, glorification, all of that kind of stuff. How does the Bible speak of the categories of sexual sin? So I said it talks about it from a negative standpoint. Well, the Bible speaks of two categories of sexual sin. And this is very relevant and pertinent today. One of the categories that it speaks of that is narrower is the category of adultery. Speaks of that. What is adultery? Well, adultery is every sexual act where at least one of the participants is a part of a covenant of marriage. The question then becomes, is the only sexual sin spoken of in the Bible related to adultery? And the answer to that is no, because there's another category in the Bible when it comes to sexual sin, something called sexual immorality. What constitutes in the Bible sexual immorality? Well, the Greek word is porneia, where we get the word pornography, covers all range of sexual sins and is not just exclusive to intercourse. D.A. Carson, who's probably the greatest New Testament theologian alive today in North America, says exactly that. It covers the entire range of sexual sins. It's not exclusive to intercourse. It's an umbrella term. It's referred to at times by people as a junk drawer term. Covers and includes adultery, but it's a term that also speaks of fornication, incest, prostitution, rape, lust, and so forth. 1 Corinthians 13, again, not on the screen, but a verse, if you want to look it up on your own, says this, the body is not meant for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 3, you can put that on the screen. Paul writes there, this is the will of God, your sanctification. You want to know what God's will is for your life, that you abstain from sexual immorality. So we have these two terms, adultery, we have sexual immorality. What is the Bible's counsel regarding the danger and temptation towards sexual immorality? Well, first off, the danger of sexual immorality is the reason for Paul's instruction in 1 Corinthians 7, where, and I'll read this, because of the temptation of sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. Now, I want you to hear, I'm going to get up and start walking a little bit. I want you to hear what Paul is saying there. Paul is saying the danger of sexual immorality is such that his counsel would be, if you're in a relationship and you're horny and you can't control yourself, get married. That sexual immorality is that dangerous, he would say, get married. Which is so bass-ackwards than the counsel today. Today it would just, it's almost opposite. Because this is more dangerous than even getting in a marriage that perhaps you don't even know each other, you haven't known each other for that long. Which suggests to me, and I think it should suggest to us, that perhaps we don't take the topic of sexual immorality as serious as we should. So that's Paul's counsel. Now the question is, if I'm dating someone and we're having a tough time and I really don't want to marry them and I can't control myself, we can't control ourselves, then what do you do? What's the counsel within the scriptures in regards to this particular situation? Well, I want to be really clear with this. Bible speaks to this a lot. One of the things it says is we are to flee from it. 1 Corinthians, none of these are on the screen, but 1 Corinthians chapter 6 says, flee from sexual immorality. I mean, get out of there. If you're not going to marry that person, get out. But don't try to grin and bear it. Flee it. Don't mess with it. It's that serious. I mean, Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount talking about lust of the eyes says it's better to cut off a hand. That's how serious this is. Better to cut off a hand than mess around with it. And that's what Paul says, flee it. Also goes on to say in different places, resist and draw near. Resist and draw near to who? James 4, 7 and 8. Submit yourselves therefore to God. Resist the devil and he will flee from you. Draw near to God and he will draw near to you. That's why, and I've said this so many times over the years, especially to guys, but this pertains to women as well. But I'm all for accountability groups. I talked about this last Thursday in our men's. I'm all for accountability groups. But if in your accountability groups, all you're talking about is the sin or the struggle you have, and in that you're not drawing near to Jesus and growing in that relationship, you will never have success over it. You'll never have victory over it. We need to draw near to God, resist at the same time, and we'll talk about other things that we can do. Put to death, Colossians 3, 5. Put to death, therefore, what is earthly in you, sexual immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, covetousness, and so forth. The overriding truth in this, guys, the overriding truth is the Bible teaches complete abstinence before marriage when it talks about our sexual practices. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Bible's really clear on it. Sex between a husband and wife is the only form of sexual relations of which God approves. Now, why is this important? Now, this is all background stuff, foundation stuff. We're going to get into the specifics in part two, specifics of dating and helps and all that kind of stuff. But if we don't get this, then we're not, it doesn't matter about the practicality on the second half. Why is this so important to you? As a follower of Christ, and if you're not a follower of Christ, why is this important? Why does God speak to it? Why is this important to a follower of Christ? Well, number one, again, it's God's desire and will for you. It's God's will for you in this. Secondly, as we've talked about, you are not your own. Again, you've been bought with a price. Again, you can see this on the screen, 1 Corinthians 6, 19. Do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit within you? Whom you have from God, you are not your own. Another reason, Galatians 5, 19, it's a work of the flesh. Now the works of the flesh are evident, sexual immorality, impurity, sensuality. And then it defiles, Matthew 5, or 15, verses 19 and 20. For out of the heart come evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual immorality, theft, false witness, slander. These are what defile a person. I guess I want us to hear how serious this topic is within the scriptures. I want us to see this great gift God has given us for a number of great reasons. It's to be enjoyed and to be enjoyed much. And to be used as a worship experience and a drawing together and a participation in creation. I mean, all these wondrous things. But then there's this other aspect where the enemy loves to just kill and destroy and twist. And what doesn't trump this is things like age and feelings and your commitment. Just because you really love one another and he's a really good guy. The culture, the throwaway line, well, Norm, that's just how you read the scriptures. No, it's not just how I read the scriptures. It is so basic and black and white and so overabundantly talked about that to come to a different conclusion would necessitate you coming in with an agenda to it. It's very, very clear that God has what's best in mind for you and wants you to enjoy this great gift, but according to how he wants it to be enjoyed. So the question to lead into our break and then going into part two is, how should a follower of Jesus living in an increasingly secular and amoral society live out their sexuality when dealing with the many temptations around us and the sexual drive in all of us? So how do we do this? Well, here's the first way, and that is to recognize that one way that we can demonstrate that we're a follower of Jesus today should be by our sexual purity. It begins there, that this is a witnessing opportunity. It's a missional endeavor opportunity. Yet it's difficult. In fact, I would say that it's nearly impossible in our own power and will to do so. It takes more than our best effort and our natural humanity to maintain sexual purity. It's near impossible in our own strength. It takes the redeeming and sanctifying work of God in our lives, which is the second way in how we can live this out as a follower of Christ and stay pure in it. And that is, second thing, fall in love with Jesus. And I don't mean to sound really pastoral when I say that or Christian-y when I say that. I mean that with all of my heart. Fall in love with Jesus. John 14:15, if you love me, you will keep my commands. Fall in love with me. As you fall in love with me, you'll live out in ways that will demonstrate that. Not as an onerous burden, but as a desire to worship me through what you do. One guy put it this way, one author writes, little souls make little lusts have great power. The soul, as it were, expands to encompass the magnitude of its treasure. Nothing else other than Jesus is big enough to enlarge the soul as God intended and make little lusts lose their power. See, what is the best buzz this life can offer outside of Jesus? Probably sex. And so what is that that can help us to live Christianly and bear witness of who we are? By how we do it. Coming through our love for him. Thirdly, how do we fight this? How do we battle this? Get into the word and get the word into you. Psalm 119 verse 9, how can a young man keep his way pure? By keeping it according to your word. I mean, how much time do you spend studying your Bible, praying, fasting, meditating, confessing, being honest before God? I mean, in those times of great temptation and lust and the things that you've given yourself to over and over and over again, how much in those times do you stop? What are you doing in that? What are you meditating on? What are you thinking about? How are you feeding the spirit? Or is all that you're feeding in your life just the flesh by what you do, what you read, what you text, what comes in? We need to feed the spirit, get the word into us as we get into the word. Here's another. From a practicality standpoint, watch where you go physically and mentally. Proverbs 5, 7, and 8, you can see this on the screen. O sons, and I would say daughters, listen to me and do not depart from the words of my mouth. Keep your way far from her and do not go near the door of her house. Where do you go physically? Where do you go mentally? Where do you put yourself? What places do you hang out in? What relationships are dangerous at this point? Maybe you need some time before you go back to them. What do you do with your time? Again, where do you give yourself, both body, mind, and spirit, on an ongoing basis? Where are you going physically and mentally? Another thing that helps in this, and I mentioned this earlier, is get a mentor, a friend, someone like-minded to assist. I'm not down on accountability, but get the right person to walk with you. Proverbs 5, 12 to 14, you say, how I hated discipline and my heart despised reproof. I did not listen to the voice of my teacher or incline my ear to my instructors. I am at the brink of utter ruin in the assembled congregation. So get a mentor, a friend, someone that can stand with you. Number six, how do we battle this? And I don't mean to be discouraging when I give this, because some of you want this and you can't find it yet. But number six is find a spouse. Find a spouse. We're going to talk about how you can do that on the second part, but find a spouse. That you are created in such a way not to keep on putting yourself in situations over and over and over again, trying to battle that on your own. Find a spouse. Proverbs 5, 15 and 19, drink water from your own cistern and fresh water from your own well. Should your springs be dispersed abroad, streams of water in the streets, let them be yours alone and not for strangers with you. You let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth. As a loving and graceful doe, let her breast satisfy you at all times. Be exhilarated always with her love. Find someone. And again, I know that's a frustrating thing to say. We're going to help you with that. I don't mean to be frustrating. I'm more speaking to the person that says, I'm keeping on putting in myself into these places and I'm going to stay this way for a long time, but I really wonder why I always fall in this area. You're not meant to stay in that area. And then lastly, if all of these things are still leading to great struggle and heartache, especially when it comes to the very prominent struggles that men have, but it's not exclusive to men, if you need to get professional help, get professional help. Some of the things that we have partnered with here and have pointed people towards, you can see on the screen, Living Waters Canada, Covenant Eyes, Triple X Church has some stuff that can help you in this as you deal with it. I've had some amazing, when I talk about professional help, I would say it's probably 9 out of 10 guys that come to my office and want to spend some time with me. Most of that 9 out of 10 that come to my office, at some point in the conversation, the topic of lust, porn habits, and the like will come up. But I've come to a point now in that process of counsel just to simply say to them, if you really are serious and want to have victory over this, you'll put your money and your time where your mouth is. There are great things out there for you that if you really want to have victory over this, you'll get an accountability partner that will walk with you. You will allow somebody to see exactly what's on your computer every day. There's systems set up where actually what you view online is sent to another person's inbox. We have accountability here on staff, not in that specific way, but in terms of looking on our computers and checking out what we have on them. That's certainly, there is no excuse for having not accountability in that area. But ministries like Living Waters has an intensive 6 month, especially for guys, but also help to women as well in this, especially women who have been abused by guys through their practices. But practices or systems set up where for a 6 month period of time, going in on a weekly basis for a time of counseling and group setups and one-on-one setups to walk through this. And I've met individuals and had guys at Westside go through these things, not just for 1 6-month stint, but in ongoing ways for 2 and 3 times through those courses have been very helpful to them. There's a lot of things like that. There's a lot of other stuff, I should say, out there as well. But if you're serious about this, it certainly can be a help to you. And it's available to you. Let me change course here. I'm trying to get some stuff done before I get to, yeah, I'll do this real, no, I won't do it real fast, but I'll, so let me do, that's all sort of background stuff, all right? I know it's a lot of information, gave you a lot of verses talking about this stuff. So let me just, with that stuff out of the way, Satan as a kind of the premise, as we go forward, let's kind of go from there, get a little more practical, and start talking about dating helps, some Christian dating helps and so forth for men and women. So if you're in this time and going, okay, I agree with you, Norm, on this. I get that it's a gift. I get that the Bible speaks of it this way. I want to honor Jesus. It's hard. I've struggled. I'm full of heartache from past decisions or guilt or whatever. I'm still trying to figure this out. I want to honor God in my single life, my Christian life, living this out. How do I do it? Well, let me give you some dating helps. Basically, four different ways that are common around the world today in terms of dating and marriage and relationships, how people come together. One is prearranged marriage. Not many people probably too fired up about prearranged marriages, but still common today. In fact, studies show that some of the most successful marriages around the world across the scale, so to speak, are those that have had prearranged marriages. You can debate that and talk about the reasons why, but that's one way people go from singleness to marriage, is through prearranged marriage. Another practice common in the church still in some places and in certain parts of the world is courtship. That became real prominent, courtship, a number of years ago in the church. That's a structured, regulated for the purpose of seeing if this person is spouse material. It's that kind of relationship that you've been brought together in a very structured way with the purpose to see if this person is marriageable material. Courtship, not too common in the church in some places. Then there's non-Christian dating, just date, find somebody at a bar, date them. Just date however you want, right? That's just do whatever, right? Meet someone, hang out with them, and just date them and do whatever you want with them. Then a fourth, is what I call Christian dating. How do we date Christianly? Let me give you some dating principles, and you take notes on this. You can chew on some of these. First of all, if you are single, number one, maximize your singleness for God. Don't waste this time in your life. Don't spend every waking moment thinking, pining, seeking, searching, and attempting to find someone that you can spend the rest of your life with. Is it a wrong thing to want to be married? No, in fact, I think it's a good thing. It's not good for people to be alone. I think it evidences actually a healthy aspect of our life. Adam was in a perfect state, and God in that perfect state said to Adam, it's not good that he's alone. So if somebody says to you, yeah, you know what, all you do is think about it, it's not necessarily a bad thing. However, don't waste this time either. And if you are wasting this time because that's all you're thinking about, then I challenge you, I encourage you in this time, don't waste your singleness. Don't waste your singleness. Maximize it for God. Here's a second thing, and some of these are going to come across like grandpa funk, all right? Second thing, do not pursue a relationship until you are ready to marry. Now, I'm going to get a little bit later and say, I'm going to talk about, let's not make too much about dating. Okay, we're going to talk about that. However, I would encourage you at this stage in your life, and we're going to talk the difference between date and dating. Do not at this stage pursue a relationship until you are ready to marry. Specifically, consider your situation. Consider where you are. And what is being ready to marry? Some of it may be happening tonight. Somewhere you just consider what a relationship is. Consider what's important. Consider what you're looking for. Some of that is readiness. Readiness is training up, helping you consider some things, thinking through some things. And also consider your situation. Consider your situation, whether it's a school situation, you're going to school, you're overwhelmed with debt, all of that stuff is going on. You're about to go over to China for a year of missions. Probably not a good idea to start a relationship today if you're going away tomorrow. Consider your situation. Consider your mental situation in terms of what you know, what you've considered, but consider your situation and give yourself this time to preparing yourself to be that spouse. Because here's the thing. I mean, Westsiders and anybody else who's here. Here's the thing. Most people don't think about marriage. They're 25, 30 years old, 35, get engaged, and they start thinking about marriage for that six-week prep course leading up to the wedding day. They've never thought about it, never considered it, even though 50, 60 years of their life is going to be spent in that relationship. Don't waste this time. Think about it. Think about what you want in a marriage, who you want to be, what it's all about, how you're living your life now. Consider all of that. Also, here's another one. Be reasonable. Be reasonable. Some of you have lists. I mean, just, right? Like toilet paper rolls. Right? Lists of what you want in that someone that you hope to meet one day. Do not set your expectations too high, but also don't set them too low either. I don't know if you saw a Vancouver Sun article that came out a couple of weeks ago. I thought it was really appropriate. The Vancouver Sun article, I can't remember the exact title, but it was talking about how BC women, especially, are really, really picky when it comes to relationships. I actually took the article. Let me read some of it for you. Some of the guys are going to nod their heads on this, but also it's going to get on the guys' case a little bit too, so I'm not just picking on the women, but this is just the culture that you live in. In Vancouver's perennial frosty dating scene, men are often called out for being too passive, right? I hear that a lot. We'll get to that on the second part. We'll hammer the guys and the ladies on the second part too. But while women have a reputation for being too picky, I've heard that at Westside all the time. That's all I hear in the lobby. Results of a national survey commissioned by online dating website Match.com, probing what single Canadians found attractive and unattractive in potential mates, suggests BC women are indeed pickier than women in the rest of Canada. In one question, respondents were asked to choose any or all the 14 attributes or habits they would consider a first date deal breaker. Across the board, from showing up late to eating with your mouth open, that's a date breaker for me if I was single again. From talking about money to not picking up the tab, BC women ticked off more no-nos than their national counterparts. BC's top deal breakers for women? Okay, guys, you need to write this down. Poor hygiene. 82%. It's a deal breaker. Like tuna in your beard, right? Even though you think your beard's really cool. Being distracted by a mobile device, 74%. Talking about their sexual history. That's, it's like, who does that? Like, who does that? And being rude to wait staff. So don't do those things. All right, guys? Canadian women were more forgiving of dates who constantly checked their smartphones, with only 59% considering a deal breaker compared to almost 75% of BC women. Almost 60% of BC women polled said they wouldn't go out on a second date with a man who ate with their mouths open, compared to 46% nationally. Long time, few more, I'll read this, and then I don't know, maybe we'll stop at that point. Yeah, we'll stop and come back. Let me read the rest of this, not very long. Longtime Vancouver matchmaker Susan Seminu, I guess is how you say her name, said women are naturally more picky than men, but Vancouver women have kicked it up a notch. She sees women, and again, this isn't just picking on the ladies because the guys have their issues too. She sees women who obsess over a partner's looks, height, and income. Some have illusions of nabbing a tall, dark Prince Charming and have unrealistic expectations. Women analyze everything, said Seminu. We are looking for reasons to dismiss. Her advice, relax. You don't fall in love with a list. You fall in love with the person. Isn't that nice? That's nice. Seminu also urged women to be more forgiving of a first date faux pas. First dates are not the best barometer, she said. Some guys tank the first date. They're nervous. As long as he doesn't do something really rude or obnoxious and there's intrigue there, give him a chance. Chan said there are women who zero in on the superficial stuff, but maintains there is an important distinction between being picky and having standards, including expecting poor etiquette and manners and consideration from your date. Let me go through, what time is it? Let me do this. I'm going to come back. I've only given you a couple of, we'll take a 3-minute break. But before we do, I want to show you a 3-minute video.